My name is Janet Grant. I'm one of the directors here at Holden, and I'm here to host this evening. Our forum tonight is called How Do We Welcome the Stranger? For those of you who were around last week, we had a similar sounding forum, but it was focusing on immigration. This week we want to focus on our congregations in our neighborhoods, right where we are. How do we welcome the stranger who is amongst us? And we've invited some people to help us start the conversation. But this is really a conversation for all of us. And I have a couple of things I want to say before we begin, and then we'll let these people say something. First thing I want to say is a prayer. So if you would join me in that. Gracious God, we thank you for the opportunity to be in conversation, to listen to one another, to speak clearly, to be challenged and to challenge, to learn. We thank you for the strangers amongst us, that we might get to know one another. Help us to learn to be welcoming people. We pray these things in your name. Amen.
Amen.
This past winter, our community deliberated long about a statement related largely to language. I want to read a bit of it as a context for our conversation tonight. The essence of our being at Holden Village is our commitment to the message and mission of Jesus Christ. Consistent with that mission, our goal is to use language which opens the gospel to us and opens our hearts to the gospel. We invite everyone's participation in this ongoing conversation. So we ask all, when speaking, to be sensitive and intentional. We ask all, when listening, to listen openly and with grace. That was a part of a conversation that the winter community had here, but I hope that the idea of listening and speaking with grace carries on to this community here now. My role tonight is to introduce our topic and our presenters, our speakers, and to facilitate and to see that we end in a timely fashion about an hour from now. Your role is to speak clearly, to listen intently, to share an observation, an experience, or a hope that might be different from one you've heard, or to affirm or clarify an opinion or idea that has already been stated. Our roles together are to be in dialogue, to be in conversation together, to honor each voice. So tonight I've invited three people to speak for about 5 minutes each about a different topic that they know something about from their own personal experience related to the issue of welcoming strangers into a congregation or a community. And then we'll open it up to a larger conversation where we can all talk to one another and with one another. And we probably won't come to a resolution or a neat and tidy ending, but when we come to that point that feels like an ending or is about an hour from now, I'll make sure that happens. Or maybe it'll be before then, who knows. So I would like to ask Jim Fergan, who's on our teaching staff this week and is the director of the Compass Center, to speak first for about 5 minutes and first introduce yourself. I know, I'll tap you on the shoulder. Introduce yourself briefly and then to talk about welcoming the person who is homeless, mentally ill, the people you welcome into your place.
Thank you, Janet. I believe that I'm going to use just a biblical story that I believe is a real beautiful example of welcoming the stranger. And that's the story of Abraham and Sarah and the strangers who came to visit them. And it's a very detailed description of what Abraham does. He immediately organizes Sarah, and Sarah then in turn organizes Abraham to go out and take care of the needs as far as the hunger of these strangers that have come to visit them. And so their needs are taken care of. And Abraham is very busy, and Sarah too, in providing the meal. I mean, it's really a good quality, dignified, well-balanced, nutritional meal that's provided to the strangers. And then we're told that Abraham does something very special. He stays with these strangers and listens to what they have to say. And I believe that we need to follow that kind of example. And the strangers, of course, that I think are very prevalent across our nation are the homeless people. And 5 years ago, there weren't any such things as food banks that were operated out of churches. And I know that in the King County area, that probably 3 out of 4 churches have food banks within their facilities to be able to provide for the needs of the strangers who come at particular times. There is also a very well-organized ecumenical ministry to homeless people on the east side of King County, of the Seattle area, where there are 12 churches who have banded together and open up their church building for homeless people to come and sleep and live at night in shelter. And so every night at and from 9 in the evening, usually until about 9:30, until about 7:30 in the morning, there are anywhere from 15 to 25 homeless people at a particular church for a month. And these churches then provide for the needs, meals, a conversation. And usually there are members of the congregation who are there in that church with these homeless people, and usually till about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and then they go to sleep. They're provided with mats and blankets and so forth and so on, and a clean, decent place for them to be. In the University District, there are many homeless teenagers, and there are 7 congregations in that particular area have gotten together, and not only, there are also some 2 synagogues and 5 Christian congregations that open up their doors to anywhere from 15 to 25 homeless teenagers, so that the teenagers are off the streets and have a place to sleep and meals. And in downtown Seattle, a major step has been when Gethsemane Lutheran Church, one of the oldest churches in downtown Seattle, opened their doors to homeless women who have no shelter. And so now there are anywhere from 15 to 20 women who sleep there and take care of the place. And these are women who, there are no shelters available for women there. Denny Park Lutheran Church, another very old church, has opened up its building that wasn't used before as a teen shelter, where there are now 20 to 25 teenagers who are sheltered there every night. Catholic Community Services, about 5 years ago, was able to get a very large warehouse that was owned by the Coast Guard at Pier 36, and now there are 210 men who sleep there every night. And every night, there's a different Catholic faith community, a Christian church, who goes there and provides meals and conversation for the men who are bused there every night to sleep there. And so the church community, the faith community, have really responded in a very, very wonderful way in welcoming the stranger. At the Compass Center, this Lutheran organization, which is right in Pioneer Square, there are many congregations that are involved in the activities of the agency in welcoming them, in providing meals and conversation and a lot of other services, and so that the stranger, who is very frequently passed by, is welcomed by the faith community. And I believe that that's a tremendous response from the church community. victims of domestic violence, people who are mentally ill, people who have lost their jobs and their ability to cope with the struggles and the successes that are demanded by society have fallen by the wayside. And it's extremely important that we are the role of the Good Samaritan in whatever way we can.
Thank you. Joan Hunt is on our teaching staff this week. She's a Lutheran pastor, most recently in campus ministry, but now has moved to a regular church. And she's going to talk to us about welcoming women and women who may not have felt welcomed into the Christian community.
My stories about that come from campus ministry, because one of the most successful things I did in the 4 years I was at campus ministry at Portland State University, by successful I mean one place where I talked to more than two or three people at a time, was when I taught women's spirituality and religious experience at Portland State. Students could take the class for credit, and so they came in classes of 20 to 35 students every time I taught it with my Catholic colleague in campus ministry. And what we found is that the students were overwhelmingly women. In a class of 35, there might be two or three men. And they were taking the class because they considered themselves to be on a spiritual search, and they didn't feel safe when they went to local churches. They thought what would happen if they came to a local church, priest, pastor, rabbi, is that some doctrine would be crammed down their throats and they would be expected to follow the party line and just give up any freedom of choice and autonomy, and this is what our church teaches, this is what you must believe. And they preferred the academic setting where they could, we always said to them, this is a banquet of hors d'oeuvres that we're going to give you. And you're free to put on your plate what you want and to leave what you don't want. We'll introduce you to a whole lot of things. You have within yourself the power and the wisdom to know what's life-giving for you and what is not. And so don't take anything that's not going to be life-giving to you. And then we would teach them our whole course of things, which involved trying to acquaint them with, particularly with Jewish and Christian feminism, and also because it was a state school and we were talking about women's spirituality, the women's spirituality movement that includes the kind of the New Age women's spirituality movement that looks at goddesses and nature, religion, and that kind of thing. And we would have speakers in to talk about that, since that wasn't the persuasion of either one of the teachers, but we would have those women in on panels usually. And what we found is that the students wanted to use what they learned in class as part of their own spiritual journey, and that they did feel freer and safer, and that they were really without spiritual community and didn't have a clue where they could find other people who would nurture them in their spiritual lives. Most of them had some kind of ritual life of their own, prayers that they did sometimes rather almost superstitiously, prayers or rituals that they did. And it was such a relief for them to be in a community of other people to talk about, to share their ideas, to find some new ideas. It was just amazing. Now, I already told you, these women are not going to show up at our congregations. They ranged in age from 18 to 18-20, the ones who were just out of high school and went to Portland State, to what was more usual at Portland State, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, all on spiritual search. I think it helps to know something about faith development. James Fowler at Emory University in Georgia has studied how people's faith develops over the course of their life, and that we may believe, we may be members of the same kind of church our whole life long, but we believe differently when we're young than when we're old. We're a lot more dependent on the people around us for what's right and what's true when we're young. And then there comes a period in many people's lives when we need to question, we need to reject some things that our heritage has given us. We need to find out what helps other people believe, what kind of faith they have. We're very angry that the faith we were raised with doesn't have all the answers or disappointed us in some major way. I have to also add that these women, without fail, who were angry with the church, were angry at the church for good reason. When I asked them what had happened, it was always something that really was insulting, really was disappointing, really was a betrayal, really was a lack of support or understanding. So people who are angry with the church are justified in that. And I wish there were some way to say not every church is like that, or try it again, or it can be different, or you can be part of the community and part of the answer that will make it different. They didn't necessarily hear that. And as part of their faith development at this stage and age of their life, they needed to be supported in their anger. They needed to hear, you're right to be upset about that. That is unconscionable. You can find inspiration and things that will help you in your faith from another denomination, another religion. And then also be invited to look at the religion they've been raised with to see if there were resources there for growth. But that's stage four, and that's hard for churches to support and sustain, that angry questioning phase. And if there would be a way for us to institutionalize support for angry women and angry men and angry young people, I mean, this is what campus ministry has tried to be for the church. And as you probably know, campus ministry funding has gone down and down and down and down and down, so that campus ministers, my former colleagues, spent more and more of our time raising money so we could stay there. So the proportion of time we could actually spend in ministry was smaller and smaller. And so without an arm like campus ministry, I don't know how these women can be welcomed into our churches, except that we can welcome them into our lives if they happen to be our neighbors or our students or the people who work at our food co-ops or wherever they might be, we might run across them.
Thank you. Thirdly, we have Lottie Ekblad, who is a member of the long-term community here at Holden. Previous to coming to Holden, she and her family are members, or have been members, are members of a congregation that is open and welcoming of gay and lesbian people. And we've asked her to talk about her experience of that. And
I guess firstly I'd like to share personally what happened in my family that was a springboard to wanting to get involved in a church like Wallingford. Sophomore year in college, I was home on Christmas break, and my dad called a family meeting. And my dad is big on meetings, you know. Usually the screen door was kicked in, you know, we need to work on not slamming that door, or, you know, he's an engineer. He was very, things were very organized. Things went very smoothly, and so we were like, okay, another meeting day, you know. But this was a meeting because my dad announced to us that he was gay and that he was coming out of the closet to us, to our family. And I was just blown off my chair. I was just... all of us were. It was very much of a surprise to me, especially. My brother and sister had heard some murmurings within our community. I grew up in southeastern Vermont, pretty small town, and this was quite an obvious, or, I mean, anyway, it's like news travels fast. My dad, in a lot of ways, it was very much a stranger coming to me. In other ways, it wasn't, because my dad was very reserved in his emotions, and all of a sudden, the floodgates were open, and he was a very different person to me, and he came needing my love and my care all of a sudden, and that was very different to me. That was very strange. And so it's been a real process for me to come to get to know my dad and to understand that he is a gay person and understand all of that means, and to understand again in a new way my relationship with him. And so when Dave and I decided to settle in the Seattle area, we really were church hunting, and a lesbian friend of ours who we had been to a 7-week Bible study down at the Oregon Extension with, she said, "Hey, you guys, I found this great church that," foremost, she really felt like the pastor who's there, she really shared stories of which that, or just shared a new kind of gospel that was very much alive for us. And so, and secondly, it was a reconciling congregation. And so I really felt like this was important for me to attend there and to get involved, because it was a way of being able to understand my dad better and to really accept and welcome him back in a deeper way. And I think the biggest part of being in Wallingford is that for me, I've gotten to know people who are gay and lesbian, and they are my friends, and they are just like me, and I can love them, and I can accept them. And, you know, it's still, in a lot of ways, a challenge for me to be there, because there's part of me, because of the very conservative church I was brought up in, that I just, no, this isn't quite okay, but mostly I feel good about being there. So that's been the stranger that I've been learning to welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. These people have shared a bit about some of the strangers they have struggled with and enjoyed welcoming. I'd open it up to the conversation up to strangers that you struggle with welcoming in your congregations, in your community, or reactions or responses. So the conversation is open to us all now. Sven.
You talked about welcoming angry women. How do you do that? Between you, and you might be able to talk to each other, but the real genuine dialogues doesn't seem to be possible.
Yeah. You can't invite them into your own territory. It has to be a safe space that's somewhere else, but you can go to be with them there. And you need to not try to proselytize them, but you do need to represent who you are with some warmth and integrity. I think the proudest moment for me in that whole series of classes was one time on an evaluation when someone said, "The main thing I've learned this term is that not all Christians are ignorant bigots." Now, that's not a person who's going to join your local Lutheran church in a week or two, but that's a big insight for that person, and it certainly means there's going to be more peace in the world.
Anyone else have a response to Sven? I promise these people they wouldn't be considered experts.
Yeah.
So.
And say you mentioned fourth stage. What's first, second, and third?
In faith development theory, the first stage is usually tied with an age, a 2, 3, 4-year-old, where what you believe is what your family believes, and you can't really differentiate really what you believe or don't believe. God is kind of like your mom and your dad and the people who are kind and warm to you. So it's there are fancy names for all these stages that I don't have on the tip of my mind. but that one is something like undifferentiated, or something like that. Stage
Piaget
two.
Piaget type of stuff.
Yes, yeah, it's developmental stuff, very much like Piaget. Your brain matures, so you think differently at different ages. This is your spirit matures, and so you believe differently. Stage two is the stage where it's kind of a cartoon stage, primary school. They're good guys and bad guys. Our religion is on the side of the good guys. I got to learn to be a good guy. You know, I'm going to try to be good. I'm going to try to please Jesus and God. And, you know, my family is, my Sunday school teachers are helping me do that. Stage three is called, I don't remember what it's called either. But stage three is the adolescent type faith, where you're in an in-group and there's them out there and we believe this and they believe that, and we have this leader or this authority. It may be the Bible, it may be a minister, it may be some other sort of thing, but you kind of check with each other to see what it is that you all believe. And it's my conviction that most congregations are set up to support stage three thinking. There's us and we enjoy being together and we have good fellowship. And we may serve them out there, but our version of ministry is we would invite them out there to come in here and be one of us. And then stage four is the begin, which, if it happens at all, I mean, some adults mature at stage two and they never get any farther, and they're always looking for good guys and bad guys. But stage four may happen at late adolescence, leaving home, or at some midlife crisis when suddenly your faith as it's held you together falls apart, and then you go out on this journey looking for your own faith. What is it that I believe? And what is it that I don't believe? And you throw some things out and put some things in. Stage five is when you've pretty much accomplished that task of knowing what it is you believe, and you say, I'm never going to master everything anyhow. God is bigger than any of my descriptions of God. And so that one is called something like a post-critical mysticism or something like that. You kind of relax into whatever faith community you choose to belong to, knowing that this one's as good as most any other one, and you can praise God here, and it's not perfect, but you can live with the contradictions and accept other people's being different. And then stage six is Gandhi and Mother Teresa and Luther King, the universal one, a person who can see God in anyone, anywhere, anytime. James Fowler, you can find his words.
Done.
I was thinking about how there is a kind of cloak of silence that happens in lots of congregations, and that all of the people that you are talking about are in some ways connected to those congregations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of the women who come to tell me that their nephew is dying of AIDS, mm-hmm. and but they don't quite know what to do with that publicly. Mm-hmm. Or the parents who come because their children are angry and they won't come to church and all that kind of stuff, you know, that and the mentally ill and the alcoholics who kind of fall off, but are still kind of connected to families and so on. But at times it seems to me that we have a kind of a self-righteous cloak that hangs over, a cloak of expectancy that hangs over the parish, that somehow we're all the perfect guys, or we're the people who have it all together. And I don't know how we will learn to do this again, to live very gracefully in some ways. And maybe it's not possible. I mean, I have a daughter who is a lesbian, so that I am struggle with that issue. No, I don't struggle anymore. I mean, she's taught me more than I know about many other kinds of things. But I think we're all connected, that we have the connections. I think sometimes we're really afraid of them. Mm-hmm. And we're afraid to be open about that kind of uncertain space, eh? Mm-hmm. And therefore we become judgmental and, you know, oh, monks anyway. And but I think that we have the connections. But how are we going to announce them and celebrate them and do something with them is a kind of, I think, an important struggle I have as pastor.
So I think in many cases, you're right, the connections might be pretty thin, might be very stretched. It seems to me that those who are in the congregation, relatively comfortable, and however else you might want to describe them, perhaps might adopt as a goal that they would, if not on a daily basis, at least a weekly basis, try to get to know someone who was dramatically different in some profile, some aspect of the profile, than what they are. And if they did that on a, with some sincerity, I think every one of those connections could perhaps be shortened up a bit, thickened, and that at least might be one way to make those connections a little bit more reliable.
John?
Yeah, I guess I'd like to complicate it a little bit. The three of you and the three issues that were raised are easier for me personally than some other ones. I was delighted one time when someone was honest to say, yeah, our church is very open. We're open to anyone to our left. And that was at least honest. I would have more trouble welcoming Rush Limbaugh to our community and to say you are fully welcome here. Or as soon as you're reconciled in Christ or a reconciling congregation, is the homophobic person who really is strongly homophobic welcome there? And is there no line? Do we say the militia is okay? Or does Jesus talk about nonviolence? How many strangers do we welcome, and when are do you not have anything that says some are welcome and some aren't, because we do believe a few things? I'd like to complicate it a little bit. It's a forum, isn't it? Yeah.
He's not a good guy.
I would like to respond to that, John. I think that everything is told in relationship to those on the right in the story of the Good Samaritan. I think the lawyer, the scribe who comes and asks the question of Jesus, who is my neighbor? Who is the stranger that I should welcome? And I think that Jesus, by means of the story, speaks it real clearly. And then the scribe answers his own question. And Jesus just says, just do it. Just do it. Go to the priest and the Levite who went by on the other side and encourage them. And be the gospel to that person. Sit next to Rush at one of his rush hours or rush, what do they call them, the rush coffee places or whatever they are. And one has to, I think, be in touch to sit down and eat with these with this population also.
Now I have a question for you. Now the congregation where I'm located now is right on the interstate. Last thing before the entrance to the interstate, and is on a light rail stop. Great location. But we get a lot of transient people coming through. And one of them that I welcomed may have broken into the church later in the week and robbed it. Want to comment?
It is a tremendous risk to welcome the stranger. At the Compass Center, we are constantly taking risks, and we're getting burned on those risks. I mean, we invite drug dealers to use the hygiene center and to eat their meals there. And this community where this agency is located is all business. It's all been gentrified. And the business community has now gotten up in arms and threatening us with a civil nuisance suit and to close us down. And the community has gone to the Department of Housing and Human Services and to the mayor's office and to United Way and to the police department and have made complaints galore. And it's a terrible risk. It really is. It's always a risk to live on the edge of what I consider to be the gospel.
Buzz.
I've observed an interesting phenomenon in my 27 years in the Pacific Northwest of the church, and that. I'll say it bluntly, and then I'll try to clarify what I'm talking about. That the most liberal people in the church become the most dogmatically setting apart those to their right. I have observed in the last dozen years that the most liberal of our clergy in the Northwest Washington Synod have created a situation in which the clergy of my age and even younger who tend to question many of the causes of the liberals among the clergy get shut out. They are now the strangers. They feel estranged. They do no longer even feel welcome going to synod assemblies or to synod pastoral conferences because they have been put into a position of being looked down upon by the liberal clergy who in effect say to them, you're really out of it. I see the church making strangers in some of the strangest places, and that is being created, from my perception anyway, trying to stand in the middle where I've been playing my game for years. Liberals call me conservative, conservatives call me liberal. I've observed this as being a phenomenon strange to me because it's invariably the liberal folks in our churches who become most determined not to allow others a place.
What did you want to say, Marion?
Well, actually, it got off. I keep plugging into everything that everybody's saying. If I get a thought form, then I've got another thought. I guess I wanted to go back to the comment, I think it was John that mentioned about have we lost the right to judge? Where, and if we've lost that right to judge, where and why have we lost it? To judge a person, a stranger, to make judgment. Have we watered ourselves down in our society where everything is okay, no matter what it is, it's okay? I mean, this is kind of a general statement, but we have changed. We've changed our attitude so much, and our society's changed so much and so fast over the last 10 years, and I have seen movements of breaking down the establishment and breaking down all the social mores and all the things that have kept our society together for generations, which keeps any society together, all of this has been broken down in a narcissistic society that says, I will only do what feels good, and anything past that, I will not accept. And if I don't feel good doing it, I'm not going to do it. And so suddenly, what has been the stability of our country, church-wise, if you will, let's just say spiritually, has all of a sudden now become an enemy because it's within a framework that is tough. Being a Christian is tough. It's hard. Sometimes I wish I weren't. It would be easier to go the other way and do what my body wants me to do or whatever is the easiest. But the easy, that's not Christ's way. And I, and this really is, bothers me a lot. I don't know what the answer is. I only know the way that I feel. And I feel that the more this stability is taken away from the church, the more fingers that are pointed at me because I choose to do the difficult things, because there's all a whole bunch of people out there saying, no, you know, you do what you want to do and you don't do the difficult things. I'm being put on the outside. They're making me, I'm a stranger. I'm a stranger to them. And I get angry about this. I just become very angry. So suddenly, I'm becoming a victim also. All of a sudden, I'm that angry woman that you're talking about. And I didn't start out angry at all. There's a real breakdown. And pretty soon I don't know who are the victims and who are the perpetrators. We're all victims.
Isn't it possible to distinguish between the individual and the behavior? And I would perhaps suggest that we still, I don't know if I want to use the word right to judge, but let's say that I might be more comfortable judging the behavior, but I'm not sure we ever had the right to judge the individual. Mm-hmm. At least that's my understanding anyway. Regarding the other comment, Buzz, I don't know about Northwest Washington, but in Minnesota, I think it's not just the extreme liberals, it's also the extreme conservatives. The only thing is, in Minnesota, they don't belong to the ELCA, they belong to some other group, but they're equally intolerant. You're just not coming in touch with them because they belong to a different organization. My sense is that the extremists on both ends are, as you described them.
I expect that from conservatives. I don't expect it from liberals.
Oh, I see.
I want to say something about the gift that can be brought by a stranger. Couple falls ago, I found out about a family of six from Honduras that were staying in a tent in the backyard of some apartment building and needed another place to put up their tent. And I rashly said, I have a big backyard. They can use my backyard for their tent until they find the house that they were looking for. And when they came to my backyard, my children were with their dad in another part of town, and my house was empty except for me and the cats. And so I said, well, come inside. And they had trouble finding another house to move to, and in the end they were with me for 6 weeks. And I have one bathroom, and that put at times 9 people in the one bathroom in the morning to get ready for school. And I found out that I was a much better liberal than I was Christian. When I stood there saying, this is my bathroom, why can't I get in there, do my own shower, et cetera, et cetera. And so I learned something about myself and my lack of compassion and, you know, how deep my compassion didn't go. And was, it was really valuable for me to grow, to not just be a liberal, but to be a little more faithful and hospitable. And I appreciate that. Not to mention the fact that we have some friends from another culture now that we didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And the L'Arche community, I relate to the L'Arche community in Portland. It's a part of that international movement where there are houses of people who are adult, mentally disabled people living in extended families with adult, non-disabled people. So that the helpers of these retarded people never go home. They live there with them. They live in a family. And many of us probably don't have contact with adult mentally handicapped people. But again, I look forward to going to the L'Arche that I can to share supper with them, because I am always warmly welcomed. I know I'll be hugged by at least four different people and greeted, and just being there is a celebration of life. And so that those strangers, most of us would like to keep quite strange, actually have quite a gift of joy and hospitality to share with us when we open ourselves to them. Mm-hmm.
Roxy.
We have a lady in our congregation at a downtown Episcopal church in Tacoma, and her name is Sally Green, and whenever a stranger comes into the church, she goes and sits with them, and sometimes they continually come back, and there's a particularly, I don't know what's the matter with him, but he has physical problems with his face and his ability to talk, and I don't know if he's retarded, I think so. But anyway, she always, if he's there, she goes and sits with him. And one Sunday, she bought a great big half sheet cake, all decorated with happy birthday on it, and put it out there for coffee hour in his honor and celebrated his birthday. And of course, we thought, well, this is really nice, you know, she's found out his birthday and all that. Well, about 2 weeks later, he said, gee, he said, this is my birthday. And and we all kind of went, we just had a birthday party for you 2 weeks ago. Oh, that's right, says he. And I thought that was just such a wonderful thing, because I couldn't imagine that anyone would have celebrated a birthday with him for years, you know. But all of us did, and we all joined in and enjoyed his birthday cake and said happy birthday and patted him a lot. And I mean, we all know him, but he's always going to be a stranger in our midst, because he's never going to be able to so-called get up to speed with the rest of us. He's not on the same, we're all on a journey, but he's on a different one. And so it's great if we can get on his journey for a little while, even for a coffee hour. And we just really enjoyed that. And one time we were having a women's luncheon. I mean, we'd been planning this thing for a year, and there were 90 women there, and everything was perfect. And somebody came to the side door of the church, one of the street people, and said, are you serving dinner here? Well, for a while, our congregation had the people serving dinner from, the Catholic Church downtown serves dinners all the time. And they were remodeling their building, so we let them come in and do all the things they would normally do in their building in ours for about 6 months, only it ran over. And by the time this women's luncheon was coming around, why, they just scrambled to get out of there before we came in. And in fact, they weren't clear out of there. And so this guy came to the door and he said, are you serving lunch? Well, lunch was done being served for you, you know, like at noon, not now. And so there was some lady back there, the Martha lady, I called her, telling this guy to go away. And Sally Green saw him. And she said, oh, for heaven's sakes, let's get him something to eat. And she was just fussing around there getting him something to eat. And I thought, this is it. This is really it. And he sat out on the porch in the sunshine. I mean, she was going to have him come sit right with her at the table at the ladies' luncheon. I mean, he really would have felt strange being there with all of them. But it was really neat. I don't know what we would be without Sally Green in our congregation. We would just not be the same.
Lita.
I just want to tell the incident that happened. I'm not trying to be left or right. This is just what happened. This man came to the church and started making inappropriate comments to almost all of the women in the church. And that did not do him any good. There were several ladies left the church because of this man. We also have a daycare. And he started coming around there. And the women, the mothers of the children, became very upset and pulled their children. I don't think he belonged there, myself. And he's gone to several other churches in the community and has said inappropriate things to young girls and to married women and women my age. And he stood right up in a forum one time in church and announced what he was looking for. And I just don't think that that's appropriate. And I don't mean to be unkind or unwelcoming, but what about the women that left the church? What about the safety of the children? Do they not count? Well, that's my question.
Sounds like you should have called the police to me.
I would suggest that there is inappropriate behavior on the part of what we would consider to be strangers. And that cannot be just passed by. People must be held accountable for their what they say and what they do. And the results, the consequences for inappropriate behavior have to be laid out very, very clearly.
It was. Our pastor really came down hard.
Right. And we have this at the Compass Center. People are, if they do things inappropriate and unacceptable, the consequences are you cannot use any of the services that are provided. We love you, but this is the kind of tough, steadfast love that is available for you. There is a way to live, and judgment is absolutely essential. We judge what people do and what they say, and the result of what I would consider to be Christian judgment is the result of, hopefully, changed behavior. That's what we hope for. Our chaplain, Nair, sits on our bar committee at the Compass Center, and people are barred anywhere from 1 week to 1 month to 6 months to a year from all of the services provided. They can't even come in there and take a pee. Can't come in there and have a cup of coffee. Can't get their mail there, and it's the mail address for 3,500 homeless people. But they can no longer get their mail there for a whole year if their behavior is not acceptable. And I'd suggest that the same is true for people who are in the church. If you suspect that somebody has stolen and broken into, but you need to take the risk of welcoming the stranger. I believe that this is what Jesus Christ calls us to do.
Didn't you say that you welcomed a drug dealer into your place, though?
Oh, the drug, I mean, it's open for everybody. They're not welcome.
So that's appropriate. The drug dealing is appropriate?
No, absolutely not. Oh, okay. Absolutely inappropriate. We will allow no dealing, no using of any kind in the agency. But we don't use drug-sniffing dogs or search policies to determine who is the dealer and who is the user and so forth and so on. One of the things with the alcohol use within the agency, you can usually see a bulge in the sweatshirt or the jacket. See, but you can't do that when people carry a little pipe and a rock around. But when somebody is discovered doing this, the immediate result is no service. You can't use this place for this.
Go ahead.
One of the things that came to my mind was Holden and how we all feel here. How do we welcome, maybe the stranger is the word that's needs to be looked at. At Holden, we're friends who haven't met yet, and we immediately form community. Why aren't we in our churches similar to the Holden community? We moved out into the suburbs, and I went from church to church on a sojourn or pilgrimage. And I would find in the bulletin that I couldn't take communion until I talked to the pastor, but yet there I was in the middle of the service. I would find reading a prayer from the bulletin and praying for my wife. I would find the day before Martin Luther King's birthday, not a mention of anything related to the civil rights movement. I didn't find myself. I found that there wasn't a community of which I was instantly a part. And there was, I felt, a them-us kind of barrier in those congregations. And but here at Holden, you don't feel that. And we're a bunch of strangers that come up on the bus every day, and immediately we're a part of community. I'm wondering if we're doing that in churches.
I dare say, though, that there are those who wouldn't feel that sense of community if they came here, too.
Yes, and I think, too, out of fairness to the congregations and to Holden, we have to realize that we have a select few people that come to Holden. The people who come here normally know what the community is like. Yes, we don't know each other, but we have something common that bonds us together before we even get here, before we even meet each other.
And you're saying
and
that?
I'm saying that in a congregation, you have such a broad population to draw from. You have far more different kinds of people coming. Not, this place isn't for everybody. This place is not for everybody. We brought our son and daughter-in-law and their family up here, and they went home. They almost went home in the middle of the first week they were here. They just couldn't. Well, they're from, I don't want to knock Californians, but they're from Southern California. Everybody else knows. They're from the fast lane, and no way could they couldn't understand any of this. You see, Holden isn't for everybody.
But Holden welcomes everybody and is inclusive.
I know, but the people who come here are the ones who know that Holden is for them for the most part. We're repeats and repeats. And the people who come up for the first time know usually what it's about because it's been recommended by others and they know. And also, community is not built instantly. You don't come up here and instantly you're a community. You have to work at being a community. There's all kinds of different communities within this community. We have a community among our volunteer staff. Among the short-term volunteer staff, there's a community. There's also another community in the long-term staff. And it's not that we all segregate ourselves, but there is a small community, many small communities working. Our guests form yet another type of community that is different from the community that I know every day here as a volunteer.
Well, maybe that's the challenge, that we've got all these different perspectives. Because, you see, I don't see your communities.
No, not really.
I'm going on a half-day walk with one of the volunteers tomorrow. Uh-huh. I spent a quarter of my day today with another volunteer doing different things. Uh-huh. And so I'm a person that likes to kind of break down some of these community barriers and see a larger community.
But you can't break down these barriers. They're like families. I mean, we live and eat and work together, and we're bonded. I don't think you want to go in and break up these communities. I treasure the community that I have here.
I guess that perhaps what I'm talking about is, even if I'm a member of a family, I'm also a member of a group of friends. I'm also a member of a neighborhood.
Yeah.
I guess that I'm looking at, in some of our churches, the impermeability of some of these bonding communities. And I'm wondering if it's preventing people from easily coming in and making the choices. I think that we as churches and as congregations have a wonderful opportunity to be inclusive, and that what we're talking about isn't whether the people that may come and sample who we are may want to walk away or may want to stay, but whether we're inclusive and whether we're I would just see us as being able to adapt and change and regroup and be flexible.
I know that. I hear what you're saying, but it's almost idealistic. People don't change that fast. Institutions don't change that fast. I can't change as fast as society is changing. I can't do it.
But let's say that that's true. Or, you know, I'm hearing what you're saying.
Yeah.
But does that mean that we need to do away with goal setting and looking at that if we're here, where do we want to be?
No. No, it doesn't set that aside at all.
And that's maybe what we're doing tonight, looking at where we want to be going as congregations.
Well, I guess I was addressing, we kind of got sidetracked. I was addressing the issue of the Holden community.
Uh-huh.
And that's really where I came in from. So if you want to take that farther, that's fine. You know, I hear what you're saying there, too.
Good active listening. Don, did you want to say something?
I think that we face a challenge of being welcoming to the stranger, because it seems to me that our society right now, in times of stress and change, tends to move towards tribalism. And the tribalism can be the political tribalism of left and right, or whatever. Certainly can be tribalism in terms of economic status, that we are the good guys and then there are the bad guys. So it seems to me that one of the things we have to face is that this kind of tribalism is happening all around the world. That we see it, we see it breaking out in Bosnia. We certainly see it in lots of African countries. We certainly face it in Canada with the French Canadians and the whole Franco question and whether the country will hold together. But I think that it's happening all over the place. And the kind of question that we have to face is, are we going to be a part of that? Or are we going to in some ways, be different from that? And I think that what you're inviting is that we try to be something different than that. But it seems to me that as soon as we make that kind of statement, we're also having to admit that we're going to be different from a lot of other folk in our society who are saying, no, let's huddle together, let's get our stuff together and be our own tribe and exclude the rest of the world. So it seems like this is not just, I think a magnificent challenge to the church about being something different than what I see happening in most of the society, where tribalism, in whatever form, is starting to surface a lot.
salaries up. As I said in the beginning, we wouldn't come to any one final point. I think one of the questions I'm left with tonight is, who is the stranger?
Maybe we all
are. Maybe we all are. But who is stranger than whom?
But, I'm stranger than you.
Yeah. Thank you for entering into the conversation and being a part of this community tonight. And a special thanks to these three people for starting out the conversation.